It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
All right, folks, welcome to Money for Lunch. Man, I am turned on to kind of get you guys turned on, I should say. I'm excited. I've been reading this book, It's the No BS Guide to Maximum Referrals and Customer Retention, the ultimate no holds bar plan to securing new customers and maximum profits. It's by Dan Kennedy and Sean Buck. You ought to get this book and give it to several people in your organization. If you don't have an organization full of people, then you should read it yourself a couple of times. But it's a great little book. It's only, 180 pages or so. About 180 pages or so. It's very easy to read. And why am I excited about it? As a consultant, I work with tons of different companies, and they all struggle with the same thing, and that is how to grow their sales. And one of the first things I do is I set up a customer win-back program, a customer retention program. I start building a referral program. These are the three easiest customers to obtain. Customers that are already doing business with you can do more business with you. Customers that have fallen off your list because they were ignored, or maybe they didn't know everything you did. And so maybe they're using your services once a year when they could be using it four times a year because they're using other vendors. So it's so important to be able to grow our sales, but it's equally as important to maximize the customers we have. So if you don't have a way to really create customer referrals, you need one. If you don't know what, if you're not sure how your customer retention is going, again, that is an absolute must, right? What would happen to your business if you had 4 or 5 or 10 times the referrals? I mean, that would be huge for some of you guys. That might double your business. What if all of a sudden you had a absolute system that would maximize your customers' spending? So I want to talk about this. If you guys, even if you guys aren't big number people, you need to be aware of some of the numbers. And that is, what does it cost me to acquire a customer? How much money do I make over the lifetime value of that customer? Right? These two numbers alone would change your business. And then the third one is, what's my average ticket sale? So to put these in order, what does it cost me to acquire a customer? What is my average ticket sale? And then the lifetime value of the customer. So I want to talk about these because these are precious. These are gold. So cost of acquisition, what's it cost me to acquire a customer? And then average, I'm writing these down in order so I don't forget, ticket, and then lifetime value. So if it costs you $500 to acquire a customer, and let's say that you're doing that pretty good. Man, you're just bouncing along. And let's just bring it down a couple hundred bucks. So let's just say it costs a couple hundred dollars to acquire a customer. And life is great. But then, since you don't know what the average ticket is, you don't know how long it takes you to make that money back. So if it costs you $200 to acquire a customer and your average ticket sale is $100, you're losing money the minute you acquire a customer. Is that good or bad? Well, that depends, really. It could be bad. However, since you know the lifetime value of that customer, you know that that customer is going to be with you for 5 years, and the lifetime value of that customer is, you know, $10,000. Now it doesn't look so bad at all. As opposed to, you take the same scenario, it costs you a couple hundred dollars to acquire that customer. You have a $100 ticket average, but the lifetime value of that customer is $1,000. It's not bad. You're still profitable. It's just not as profitable. So what does it cost you to acquire a customer? And the way you put that together is you calculate how many customers you're getting per month against, divide that against your advertising, right? Now, some of you guys, depending on your sales force, have what I call a squishy number, because you're acquiring a customer via your sales force. So maybe it doesn't have it necessarily a hard cost like advertising. However, again, if you have 10 new customers a month and you're paying, $20,000 a month in commissions for new customers, you're acquiring them at $2,000 a month, probably $2,000 per customer. You see how that works? And so you acquire these customers. That's your first number you have to know. You must know what it costs you to acquire a customer. Second, your average ticket. This is important. So if you know that you acquire a customer for $100 and the first time they buy from you is $50. And by the way, guys, it's very common to lose money on the first purchase. You want to get them in the door. Look, grocery stores have done that for years. They're called loss leaders. You know, they want you to come into the store and buy the gallon of milk for $1. Well, think about it. You walk in the store, you got to go all the way to the back of the store to get the milk. As you're going through that store, you're probably going to pick up bread and eggs, maybe some fruit. By the time you walk out, you saved $2 or $3 on the milk, but you're walking out with $20 worth of groceries. So what is your loss leader? Having a loss leader is a great way to drive sales if you know the rest of these numbers. So cost of acquisition, your average ticket, and then the lifetime value of the customer. So these three numbers will grow your business, will save your business, will give you peace of mind. If you have any questions about cost of acquisition, average ticket, or lifetime value, reach out to me. Hit me up, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, Bert@BertMartinez.com. Be glad to send you out some more information on it. I have a whole report on that I'll be glad to send you for free. Let's get started with my first guest. I'm excited to have Wei Hung on the show. Wei Hung, award-winning money anxiety breakthrough coach, trainer, author, speaker. Wei Hung is founding member of the Six Figure Academy. He has spoken to and has inspired thousands of entrepreneurs to break through their internal mental emotional blocks so that they can create a lifestyle of prosperity and abundance without burning out. Through his own personal journey and entrepreneurship of what seemed like never-ending peaks and valleys of successes and failures, he has spent the better part of the last 2 decades refining his system through a combination of neuro-linguistic, energetics, mental and emotional release therapy, as both as a trainer, a practitioner, in all these areas. Wei Hung, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. It's good to have you here. It's good to have you here because I love this idea of a money anxiety breakthrough coach. You know, it's so funny because you talk to anybody and they all want to make money. And most of these people are already making money, but they, you know, they couldn't rub two nickels together. We seem to have a lot of, what's the word I'm looking for, confusion when it comes to our money, an almost a love-hate relationship, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that love-hate relationship is systemic in our entire culture. I mean, I think it's worldwide even. It's not just American culture. I mean, I grew up being Chinese. I guess I was born Chinese. and in our culture, it's a fear-based motivation to make the money. And it's amazing what we've been able to thrive on or think that we're thriving on a mental, emotional level when it comes to money and how much it impacts how we actually make money in our lives.
Yes. You know, it's so funny, too, because everybody has their story about some of the money lessons they learned from their parents, right? And I remember growing up, my dad used to say, you know, something like, again, I'm Spanish, and so I have to kind of figure out how I'm going to translate this, but he would say something along the line is, man, a man isn't a real man if he doesn't have at least a dollar in his pocket. And I'm thinking, you know, that's kind of a low bar there, low standard, right? I mean,
right.
You know,
if I have a dollar in my pocket, I'm a man.
I'm a man. I'm a real man. You know, it's like, man, that should be like, you know, a real man. You know, man isn't a real man unless he has $100,000 in the bank. You know, let's upgrade that standard a little bit. But you know, you have all these little things that we learn from our parents, right? And so then we. I think that one of the things that I learned, the biggest thing I learned from my parents was what they didn't do, and is that they never really sat down and say, look, this is how money works. This is why we have to save money. This is how you invest money. This is, let's do, you know, whatever. So there wasn't a whole lot of that. Most of it, you know, most of what I learned from my parents regarding money was scarcity and lack thereof and stuff like that, which I think is very normal because that's what they learned from their parents.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, and it's brilliant that you brought that up because I just recently spoke to a room full of, I don't know, 250 parents, literally on how to talk to their children about money. Because, and I brought, you know, I brought to their attention, University College of London, they actually did a survey of 15,000 men and women, and they found that only 3% of the 15 that were not comfortable talking about their sex lives. Whereas when they're talking about money, over 20% of that same group refuse to talk about money.
Wow.
Money has become the last taboo in our culture. And it's really, really weird. You would think sex would be it, but it actually is money.
Yeah, that's incredible. So, and it just kind of it goes to show you how messed up we are.
I would say messed up. I would say underinformed. Because here's the thing. The challenge that our parents had in talking about, because if they themselves had conflicts internally about money and they want to do what, and they were doing the best that they could, right? They were wanting to do the best they can. So if they showed up incongruent, they knew that we as children would somehow pick up the conflict. So it became an ego thing that we can't talk to our children about because I don't have a handle on money yet. How do I talk to my child about money? I don't feel confident about that. So I'm just going to send them, give them some books. And how I learned about money was my dad gave me my first credit card. And he gave me these pamphlets that came with, you know, every credit card that comes with all these pamphlets on, this is your credit card, this is MasterCard, this is how you use it. And he said, read these. And that was his thing. Read this, and that way you'll know how to use this credit card. I said, really? APR, I have no idea. I was like, I don't know, 15, 16. And my first lessons around money was when I misused a credit card and got into trouble. Then I got into trouble but was not told why and how to avoid being in trouble again. I simply got the money taken away. So if you can imagine, when this programming was instilled in me as a child, what I ended up doing with money when I grew up. I grew up every time I made money, six figures, seven figures. It didn't matter. When the money came in, I did the best that I could on an unconscious level to kick it out because I didn't want to get into trouble.
Interesting.
And that gave me a yo-yo effect for a very long time until I really realized it wasn't that I couldn't make money or I didn't know how to make money. It's because my relationship with my anxiety around money was running at full tilt every time I started making more money.
Yeah, no, That's so interesting. And again, it just, see, that's why I say we're so messed up, because that wasn't that part of it was informational, but it's also emotional. We have these different, you know, these things. We mentioned in the very beginning that we're, you know, a little bit of what you've learned is neurolinguistics. And I think some of that is embedded, as you said, it's just embedded in our DNA to be that way. Let's talk about this real quick. Let's talk about, you know, your breakthrough, this, how did you get into this breakthrough coach, this money anxiety breakthrough coach? How did this come about?
How did this come? That's a really, really good question. I think some of the best coaches in the world are born through rising above their challenges, their own challenges in life.
Right.
So you have coaches that coach in specific niches, and my specific niche was on money because I had such challenges around money growing up. And it wasn't because I came from poverty. It was just ongoing cycle. It was like I was on a hamster wheel, make money, lose money, make money, lose money, going from not having to worry about money, then worrying about money until I became broke, you know. And
mm-hmm.
I think when I finally broke through that pattern, I realized I wasn't the only one. I looked around, and everybody that was around was going through a similar program, a similar cycle. And I had one of the most significant events in my life was a really good friend of mine years ago was going through the same thing, except I don't think he made it out. And I don't know, I mean, God forbid, what may have happened. I don't know where he is. I don't know where his family is. I don't know what has happened to him. And so for me, there's a lot of motivators in the background of why I do what I do. And I found that just, you know, surface coaching, just taking care of what's situational at the time was just not enough for my clients. I used to do a lot of consulting work, a lot of marketing work, a lot of business consulting, development. And I was really frustrated because I could only work on the outer game and I ignored the inner game. And then they would get results and they would be happy, but I wasn't happy because I saw more. I saw more what they could do in their business and their lives. And it wasn't until I bridged the gap between the inner game to outer game to break through the really deep entrenched blocks that keep us from becoming multimillionaires or uber successful people pursuing our passion and our purpose in life. That's when I really got to the place where I wanted to be, became a breakthrough coach to break through those great walls of China that everybody has in certain areas.
Right? That's a great analogy. I love that. The great walls.
And that's really how I got into it. I looked at everything that I was doing in my life. I took an inventory of all the jobs and all the careers and I said, you know, there's a common thread in all this. And in every single one, even when I was working with celebrities and thought leaders and all these different people, that I was like, what is that? What is that common thread? Why do they have me? They retain me as their consultant, retain me as their IT guy, retain me as their financial guy. And it was because I was always coaching them through the toughest sticking points in their lives. And that's why they kept me around. I said, you know what? I might as well just embrace this and make a business out of it and do more and help more people by simply owning what it is that I'm here to do.
Right. I love that. Yeah. You know what, what's interesting is something that you said, you know, about, I think that most people, because you mentioned about becoming multimillionaire or millionaire or whatever, I think that the average person out there would have a pretty abundant life if they just knew how to manage money. There's a lot of people out there who are making 50, 60, 100 grand a year, but because they don't know money management, money investing, they're constantly broke. You know, we have this lifestyle, you know, the supersized lifestyle, right? That if you could, you know, if you go to a fast food place, it's $5 for the meal, but if you know, for an extra 50 cents, you can double the size of that meal. And we're so used to trying to get more, and show off the fact that we have a big ass watch and a big car and a big house, that these are the things that are success, that we don't stop to think that sometimes less can be more. So what if you downsized your house? So instead of driving a Mercedes, what if he just drove a nice car? Instead of having, you know, let's say a $300,000 or $400,000 house, depending on where you live. I mean, a $300,000 house is more and more commonplace. But I'm just saying, what if you just scaled it down and started saving and investing that money? Because that's where the peace comes from, is knowing that you have a bunch of money in the bank and that you have your money working for you. And my producer is just signaled me that we're running out of time, but I wanted to talk about this real quick, and we're going to have to bring you back and talk more. But sure. I wanted to talk about this way, and that is, you talk about, or you teach about, the four bank accounts of success. Talk about those real quick.
Okay. So most people, when we talk about, I want to have six figures, seven figures in my bank account, okay, they think only about one singular bank account, the physical bank account that you can see in the bank. And when I talk...
Oh, man, did we just lose? Oh, we just lost Way. Doggone it, it happens. This is what happens when you do a live show, that all sorts of things can come, can happen. So we're going to wait just a couple of seconds here and get him back. So here we go. Way, are you there?
Hey, Bert. Yeah, sorry about that.
It's all right. That's technology for you. Okay, go ahead. So people think we just want a bank account.
Yeah, the universe is saying, are they really ready? I'm going to cut him off for a second just to see if he comes back. All right, so this is a really big piece of how we help our clients get really big success. And you know, it's funny that you mentioned about the management piece, because here's the thing. If you want to have a consistent flow of cash or success in your physical bank account, there are three other bank accounts, or maybe even four bank accounts, that you have to make sure you pay attention to, which is, number one, you need to make sure that your physical body reflects what it is that you want in your bank account. Your emotional body, your emotional bank account needs to be handled. If your emotional relationship with money does not reflect the six figures that you want in your bank account, and it has this emotional scarcity, lack mentality that you don't believe emotionally that you can handle six figures, it doesn't matter how, if someone puts six figures every single month in your bank account, you're going to find a way to match your emotional bank account that does not match that six figures. Your mental bank account, which is the language that you use around money, the language that you talk, your self-talk around success and prosperity, yes, and making money, and your belief system, if that doesn't match what your physical bank account, what you want to manifest in your physical bank doesn't match, then that's going to have to be handled. And then ultimately, finally, is your energetic bank account. This is the what, this is the energy bank account where the people who drink coffee all day and say, I'm still so tired, because it has nothing to do with your physical energy. It's your energetic, field. It's the energy that you have, how your connection to higher belief system, self, and those.
That vibrational energy that everybody kind of emits, right? I mean, you get around some people and they just suck the energy away from you, right? They're just this vortex of negativity. And then you get around some people who are just positive and they're full of light and, you know, stuff like that. Absolutely. Way, we're out of time, but I would love to bring you back again soon. You know, we're also going to be doing a live filming in L.A., so I know you're in California. I don't know how often you get down to L.A., but I'd love to, you know, get you involved with that. We'll have Amy shoot you out some information, and maybe we can meet in person. Great.
Yeah, we talk a lot of the same language, so I would love to be of any support I can to you and your audience. It's great.
Great. Yeah, I love it. I love it. I'm going to do a shout-out here. Guys, if you want to find out more about Way and his team, you can go to the SixFigureAcademy.com, thesixfigureacademy.com. Wei Hong, thank you so much for stopping by.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Bert. Appreciate it.
Good stuff there. I love his energy. I love the physical bank, the emotional bank, the mental bank, the energy bank, and not to mention the money bank. All of those bank accounts are relevant in all of our lives. Quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Did you bring the camera phone?
I did.
Do you want to go first?
I've been waiting for this all day.
Okay, this is Fro and Stacy.
Introducing Chase Quick Deposit. Just photograph the front and back of your check using the Chase mobile app on your iPhone and hit send.
It went through?
So cool.
This is so cool.
You want to try it?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, it was nice.
Make a deposit from anywhere, anytime with your iPhone.
To Mr. and Mrs. Walker, why would they send my parents a check?
Chase what matters.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we are back. My next guest, David Bielenberg. David Bielenberg is the sole owner of advisor of True Blue Wealth. True Blue Wealth is a fee-only, veteran-owned, registered investment advisory firm. The firm specializes in minimizing conflicts of interest and maintaining the highest fiduciary standard for clients. The firm mission statement is to maintain the highest ethics standard by always putting clients' interests first. David Bielenberg is a professional investor and CFA charter holder with an educational background in finance, investing, and economics. David is also a decorated Iraq War veteran who served 5 years in the Marine Corps. Hoo-ah! He served one tour in Iraq 2003 before being honorably discharged to attend college using the GI Bill. David Bielenberg, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Good morning, Bert. Thank you so much for having me on the program today.
I'm excited to have you here. First of all, I want to say this, man. Thank you so much, David, to you for serving our country, for 5 years, specifically there with the Marines in Iraq. Thank you so much. We appreciate your bravery and your service.
Bert, I really appreciate that. And, you know, I really enjoy your program. I was listening to the way your last guest and talking about how people are having such a hard time achieving their financial goals and how we generally don't make the best financial decisions. And one of the things I'd like to talk about in your program today is the importance of choosing the right advisor because having the right advisor is probably the most important decision you make in achieving your financial goals. Okay?
Yeah.
So when you're choosing an advisor, the first, by far, hands down, the most important thing someone can do is to find out what their fiduciary obligations are. That's very important. I'll get to more of that in a minute. The other thing they can ask is...
Go ahead.
Fiduciary and also try to get one that's fee-only, so they don't earn commissions, and also try to get one that's independent, that's allowed to invest anywhere and everywhere and isn't limited by their firm or wirehouse to investing only in their products.
Okay, so let's talk about this because, you know, there is, unfortunately, and done purposely in my estimation, I believe this is done purposely, there is tons of confusion when it comes to me and my money, right? I mean, you have brokers, you have agents, you have all these different different financial advisors, and they all sound the same, but they're not the same. I mean, I just discovered a few years ago the difference between this fiduciary thing. So why don't you tell the audience what it is when somebody has a fiduciary accreditation? What does that mean as opposed to other financial advisor type people?
Sure. So a fiduciary is legally obligated to put your interest before their own. That's different from a broker who is not obligated to put your interest first. And a broker typically earns their money from commissions. Now, the fiduciary generally earns most of their money from the fees charged to your investments. But the brokers, they're only earning money from the commissions. Now, it's very important to understand the distinction between the two. A broker does not have is not putting your interest first. And by putting your money into products that generate commissions, usually comes at the consumer's expense. The more money you're paying the broker, the less money you have to achieving your financial goals because you have lower returns. That can add up significantly over the long run because you're giving up 1% or 2% per year in commissions and fees to somebody over 30 years that you're saving for retirement. That can have a significant impact on the final value of your investments when retirement comes. Here's where the industry makes it confusing. Just like you said, Bert, the industry is so confusing out there. And when I was researching this a few years ago, I got confused. That's how confusing this is. So there, if you ask an advisor out there, fiduciary, many of them will say that they are. But what they don't tell you, and a FINRA study recently showed that 90% of the advisors are also registered as brokers. So the smart audience will realize that there's a conflicting objective there, right? How can you be registered as both? That's because they will wear a they will wear both hats, and they will switch hats when working with you, and you will never know. So this is how a typical interview can go with an advisor. So you can sit down with your advisor, and when he's laying out your investment strategy, like your financial goals, he's laying that out for you. He's acting as a fiduciary. He's putting your interests first. But 15 minutes, 20 minutes later, when he's recommending which investments you go into, he can be acting as a broker. And by acting as a broker, he can recommend a product that earns him a commission that you may not otherwise need to be invested in. So the consumers can protect themselves by first finding out what their fiduciary obligation is from their advisors. You can simply, it's best to get this in writing, or you can ask them, are you a fiduciary all of the time? Because if you ask them as a fiduciary, they're going to say yes, but they won't tell you that they're also a broker. So, but best, the people can best protect themselves by getting this in writing.
Yeah, I love that. And I hope a lot of people picked up on that, that a broker, specifically a broker, and by the way, I think it's a great name because a lot of brokers actually keep you broker, right? But
yes, sir.
You know, bottom line is, that's right. But a broker will make money when they sell something on your behalf or sell you something, and when they sell it to you and when they sell it for you. So if you can imagine, you know, you buy 100 shares of XYZ stock, they make a commission. When they sell that 100 shares of XYZ stock, they make a commission. Whether or not you make money. And right. Most, if not all brokers, and you correct me if I'm wrong, these are captive associates, and so they're limited as to what they can tell you and what they can sell you.
Right, because they're only making sure that it's suitable and not that it's in your best interest.
Right, and right. Let me tell you, that was such a big shock to me. But when you look at how the system is set up, it makes sense. So, okay, I can forgive the brokers because really their job is to buy and sell stock. And okay, fine.
Right.
But what
right.
I really have a tough time forgiving is the way the system has set up all these different layers of advisors, certified advisors, you know, XYZ advisors, and all these different advisors, you know, except for the fiduciary ones, can, you know, really aren't out there to protect you. They can, you know, if you go broke, hey, there's no legal recourse because they like you said, they can, as long as it's suitable, they can get away with murder.
Right. Right. And this is the problem. You know, there's the industry has benefited from this confusion, right? By having all these different people will say they're brokers will say that they're advisors. And there's people that sell insurance products that say they're advisors too, or they'll say they're wealth managers or whatnot. So there's all these different titles and names and certifications, but no one really knows which one means what, and everyone's basically doing their own thing, making it more confusing for the consumer and basically ultimately cost the consumer money because as your last guest mentioned, you mentioned, consumers may not always make the best financial choices. This confusion just makes it more difficult for them to achieve their retirement goals, their financial goals, especially if they're saving for retirement. And that's important because right now there is basically a huge retirement crisis in this country. A lot of people are severely underfunded for the retirements that they're expecting to get. And that is one reason there was a recent Department of Labor ruling just a few weeks ago where the Department of Labor ruled that all consumer retirement accounts must be managed with a fiduciary standard. Before, the advisors and brokers were recommending products with high fees or other bonuses for their business, even if it wasn't in the best interest of the client. The reason the Department of Labor made this ruling is because it was costing people money every single year in fees and losses. So by this ruling, although some of us in the industry don't think it went far enough, we would have liked to have seen, like you said, more uniformity of standards and titles among advisors. We wanted to see that. We didn't. This only applies to retirement accounts. So a fiduciary standard in retirement accounts is a great step in the right direction because it better helps consumers achieve the goal of getting to retirement, which is already so difficult in getting as it is.
Absolutely, yeah. Okay, so go over this ruling one more time and kind of walk me through it. How do you see this helping customers again? Walk me through it again.
Before there was no standard of – there was no fiduciary standard on retirement accounts. So your IRAs, right, that you have with your advisor, the advisor could recommend – could act as a broker and recommend that you invest in products that generate commissions for him. The Department of Labor ruled that you must that all retirement accounts must be treated with a fiduciary standard, so therefore no broker is allowed to come in and say that they recommend you invest in a product that charges a commission at
right.
your expense that it would be paid to them, because when a lot of commissions that they receive typically comes out of the money out of your investment, right? So like a typical 5%, they might be a 5% commission just for the privilege of investing in a fund, that a piece of that 5% will go to the broker or advisor recommending that to you. The Department of Labor ruled that you can't do that. That will improve people's returns and their ability to hit retirement.
Oh, I love that. I love that. I think that that's a fantastic thing. And you know what? It's a step in the right direction. It has to be very clear. You know, one of the things I do love about the legal profession is that they have to tell you up front if there is a conflict of interest. And if there
right.
is a conflict of interest, they have to send you to somebody else. Sorry, we can't take your case. You have to go find another attorney.
Right.
So I think that's where we need to see the financial industry go, because it's just that important. I mean, you're talking with people's lives. You know, there's so much out there, David, that just pisses me off to no end. I mean, you know, you have fees, you have hidden fees, you have all these little, you know, the average person who's putting money in a money market account, Even
right.
if they don't lose any money in the money market account, they're still access. They have to pay for fees and maintenance fees and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
So before you know it, they've lost money, and these fees add
right.
up a lot.
Significantly. In fact, lowering your fees is probably the most important way to improve your returns over the long run. Just by improving your fees. By having your fees go from 8% to 7 or 6% can make a huge difference. And, you know, I agree completely that they're having a conflict of interest, holding the financial industry to disclosing and managing conflicts of interest better would be the best step in allowing people to make more informed investment decisions, because this is already confusing enough. Investing in finance is extremely confusing. And, you know, it's changed over the last 30 years as people have, you know, they don't have pensions anymore. So they are put in charge of managing their own money through 401ks mainly and IRAs. And that's partly why their retirements are underfunded. But now they're put in charge of their own financial futures. And so that's why we're at this point today where people are not making the best decisions, because it's so confusing, because the conflicts of interest and high and exorbitant fees that are being charged to consumers.
Yeah. Yeah, that's just crazy, isn't it? It's stacked against us. I mean, you and I could spend a whole hour talking about all the different fees that they're in there. I'm just so glad that you said that. And I hope everybody caught that. Just by you guys going back and reviewing your fees and getting those reduced, and they are negotiable and there's a lot of things you can do for them. Just by reducing those fees, you will start making more money in your investments. That's crazy.
Absolutely. Now we're talking a huge difference. But, you know, 30 years of having an extra 1 or 2% per year, huge difference in your final and the money you're going to have available to you. And you can improve that by making sure that the person has your interest first.
Yeah.
You know, and at my company, that's why we focus on the four hurdles to investing: fees, inflation, taxes, and investor behavior. This is the other part, because people are now in charge of their own financial futures. They don't have pensions anymore, right? So now they're managing their own money. They're in charge of it. They have to manage that behavior. So, you know, a lot of us, we are asked when we go to see our advisor, they ask us, how aggressive do you want to be? And you might say, well, I'm aggressive. I want to put all my money in stocks. But maybe just because you want to take that risk doesn't mean maybe you shouldn't, right?
If you
are, let's say we're not talking about a retirement account. Let's say that this is your taxable savings. Like you have some money in an account you want to have there for just to invest, and it's not there for retirement or anything. Let's say you work in, say, the advertising industry. An advertising industry is pretty sensitive to the economy, right? So let's say a recession comes, and God forbid you lose your job. Well, you invested aggressively with your money. You put it all in stocks. The recession came. You lost your job. Now those stocks might be down 20% right when you need the money, right? So
right.
Now you're selling your investments after they drop down right when you need the money. So by looking at the ability to take risk and, you know, looking at their total household profile, how much debt they have, for example, you can help the client make better decisions and avoid that behavior gap in their management, in their financial goals. Because managing that behavioral gap helps them avoid selling right when it's gone down and therefore giving them more money for their financial goals.
I love it. I love it. Hey, David, we're out of time. I'd love to bring you back and talk more about safe investing, the fiduciary way of investing. Come back and have you talk more about True Blue Wealth. David Billenberg, thank you so much for stopping by today.
Thank you, Bert. Thanks for having me on, and have a good day.
All righty. Good stuff there about you and your money. It's crazy what is happening to your money on a good day. So you thought you made, you know, you think you're up in your investments. The fees are eating that away. And as David said, 1% or 2% or 3% over time, if you understand compounding, you're literally talking about $200,000, $300,000, $400,000. Look it up. Do your homework. Find people that are accountable to doing what's best for you. All right, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, now we're going to get down with Carolyn Johnson Brown. That was the extent of my ability to come up with something with Carolyn's name. Carolyn Johnson Brown is CEO and founder of the Accountants Office LLC, which has provided virtual accounting services to small businesses and individuals nationwide since 2001. In 2010, Carolyn was honored by the U.S. Small Business Administration with a National Enterprise Award for mentoring small business owners, providing services that enhance the business owner experience, and supporting an environment for the creation and expansion of small businesses. She's a past president and charter member of the National Association of Women Business Owners, Phoenix Metro Chapter, and her firm is the recipient of the Greater Arizona Better Business Bureau Business Ethics Award, and you can check them out at yourvirtualaccountingoffice.com. Carolyn Brown, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you, Bert. I'm delighted to be here with you today.
Well, I'm excited to have you here as well. I love helping our audience learn about some of the things that they can do to better their lives and their business. So let's get into this. I'll reword it like this. What do you see as some of the most common mistakes that business owners make?
Well, I tell you, Bert, one of my favorite topics to speak on is what I call the number one most costly mistake business owners make and how to fix it. You know, I'm a lifelong entrepreneur. I've been an entrepreneur since I was in my mid-20s. And I am just passionate about helping small business owners succeed. So I've worked with hundreds of businesses one-on-one all across the country from all different industries. And if you count the business owners that I've spoken to, now we're talking about thousands, passionate about bringing either a service or a product to the marketplace. They're just gutsy people and often take off with an idea before everything is fully put into place, and they fully understand that, hey, if I'm going to have a business, you know, I don't have to just be good at what I do. You know, like me, I own an accounting firm. So I own a virtual accounting firm, and I am a good accountant. But when I started my business, I found out, you know, being a good accountant isn't enough to be a good business owner.
Right.
There's a lot of different hats, and I once saw a skit of a guy trying to put on all these different hats that you wear. You're the marketer, you're the sales department, you're the HR department, you're the accounting department, and you're the strategic planning department. I mean, we're everything. And so consequently, a lot of business owners make serious mistakes, and those can be costly mistakes.
Well, you know, and it's interesting what you said there, and I hope, you know, some, you know, people are picking up on this, is that we all do that mistake of, you know, I'm a good accountant, or I'm a good doctor, or I'm a good chef, or, you know, a good widget maker, and we forget that that's just really the beginning of your business. It's good that you're good at your core, but you as you're alluding to, there's management, there's marketing, there's all these other hats that we have to wear that can be overwhelming.
Exactly. And that is where business owners get into this area that I call the most costly mistake they can make. And it's something so simple that many business owners don't even think about it. You know, when you're starting a business, you think, oh, my gosh, everything's so important, I have to do this myself. The most costly mistake a business owner makes is a failure to successfully delegate.
Mm. Yes.
I tell business owners that 80% of what you do, someone else could do. 10% of what you do, someone else could be trained to do. And only 10% of what you're actually doing should you be doing.
Say that again. I want everybody to listen to this.
Okay. 80% of what you do, someone else could do. 10% of what you do, someone else could be trained to do. And only 10% of what you do, you really should be doing. If you stop and think of what your time is worth, what do you bill your time out to a client at? Do you bill it out at $75 an hour or $200 an hour? And then would you pay someone to do some of the things that you're doing? Would you pay them $75 an hour? Would you pay them $200 an hour? If what you're doing doesn't meet this criteria, you shouldn't do it. Ask yourself this question. Does what I'm about to do make my business grow? Does what I'm about to do make my business grow? If it doesn't,
I love that.
Then don't. Yeah, if it doesn't, don't do it.
And you know what? Let me tell you, I have a client of mine who's, I want to say pretty successful guy, has a significant, substantial worth. He has several multi-million dollar businesses. And I went to visit him one day, and he is up on a ladder changing light bulbs.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's what I said. I said, you know, what are you doing? These light bulbs needed to be changed. And a lot of that is that OCD, I want to get it done now kind of a thing. And it's such a costly impulse.
Right.
You know,
he could pay somebody $10 to do that.
Well, you know, first of all, he's got a staff of people.
Ah.
And so eventually they would probably do that. All he had to do is maybe either send a memo, hey, these lights need to be switched out or something. But it's one of those things that, you know, you're walking through your establishment and you see, oh, look, these lights haven't been put in yet. Let me get to that. Why?
Yeah.
Why?
Exactly.
And some of that, and sometimes that could be again, we all suffer a little bit of OCD, some more than others, but it's also, I think it's also, you know, maybe not 100% trusting, the situation, and so he chose not to go to a marketing meeting because he wanted to stay there, by the way, and get these light bulbs inserted.
Oh, wow.
And I'm thinking, dude, you're just, I just don't know what.
Yeah. Well, I have a fun little exercise that when I do seminars, I often take business owners through a little exercise, and it's called What's on Your Plate? And for this exercise, I have to find cheap paper plates that don't have the fancy coating on them, no flowers or designs printed on them, and that's getting more and more challenging all the time because we don't have cheap paper plates anymore. But I pass them out to people and tell them to actually write on this plate, what are you doing in your business? And as I was walking around a seminar one time, this one guy had written the word everything with an exclamation point. And I explained to him, no, you need to write down every single little thing. Are you answering the phone? Are you sending out bulk emails? What are you doing? Everything that you're doing. And I've had people do this all fancy. They had it color-coded, so all the marketing things were in one color. And somebody had like clouds on theirs for it's been fascinating. But once you do that, then you can go back and you can highlight those things that, hey, this isn't worth my time. And yes, there's someone else that can do this. And then I say, just write their name next to it. I actually did this exercise myself a few years ago, and I saved myself 5.5 weeks of my time doing this little exercise. Yeah, you know, because, I mean, sometimes the cobbler's kids are going barefoot, you know. So,
sure.
So I did this, and what I discovered was, we receive checks at our P.O. box for a number of our clients that my administrative assistant processes and takes to the bank for them. And she was receiving all the checks from our clients, but then I was picking them up and I was opening them and I was putting them in QuickBooks and I was taking them to the bank. Here I am, CEO and bank deposit maker. It's like, huh? and I also had my accounting manager sending out invoices to our clients. That meant the last 2 days of every month, I had to be in town and in my office to do that function. So I delegated those two things, and it saved 5.5 weeks a year of my personal time.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. And you know what? What happens to us, the lesson here is that we, as humans, first of all, get into this polite, you know, part of us want to be polite and part of us want to be involved and part of us want to, be helpful, right? And so
mm-hmm.
we start doing these little things, and before you know it, you're sucking up, as you said, 5 weeks of your life. Mm-hmm. Wait a minute. This has no, you know, this should not be on my plate at all. And I love the whole plate idea. First of all, money for lunch, plate, that makes sense. I mean, but I love the plate idea because especially when that person said everything, and I could see, you know, so many people like to use generalizations. Okay, what does everything mean? And then, of course, you go to the other extreme, the person who had them color-coded and everything. I could definitely see that person having everything on her plate or his plate. But, you know, so you make this plate and you go through it and you realize, wow, you're right. 80% of the stuff I have can be delegated. And then 10% can be trained. And then 10% I probably have to do myself.
Right. And that plate becomes your job description when you are looking either to hire someone or to delegate it within your team. And, you know, sometimes people say, well, I don't have anyone to delegate to. And, you know, that's not a true statement because every business owner has at least three choices when it comes to delegating. You can hire an employee, you can outsource the tasks to a professional, or you can do a combination of the two. So it's having that plate description of the things that you need to get off of your plate.
So you can hire somebody, you can hire somebody, you can outsource, and number three is a combination of the two.
Right. Yeah, that combination of the two in an accounting perspective is what we call your remote CFO. We have a lot of business owners that have an accounting clerk or a bookkeeper in their office. And, you know, the bookkeeper or the accounting clerk have got a certain level of skills, but not everything that the business owner needs. This last year, we had an interesting thing happen. We had two new clients come to us. Both of these clients were making over $15 million a year gross. So they were established businesses, and in both cases, the person that they had in-house that they were trusting all their accounting work to was not even a certified bookkeeper, didn't have an accounting degree, really didn't know accounting. They were more at an accounting clerk level, and yet they were handling something as important as payroll. So.
Wow.
Yeah, so what we do for those businesses is we come in remotely through high-speed internet. We supervise, we manage, we double-check their in-house staff, and we remove some of the things that they were doing to give the business owner better internal controls. Because it's really sad to say that a lot of business fraud goes on by people in the accounting department because they know what's going on with the money. And so having an extra set of eyes is a great way to protect your business from fraud, but also just to make sure that everything is organized in a way that's going to make it easy for your CPA so that when you're, you know, comes time to do taxes, you're going to make sure that you get all the tax benefits that you should be getting.
I love it. I love it. Carolyn Brown, we're out of time, and I would love to bring you back and talk more about business and how to be more efficient with your business. Carolyn Brown, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing.
Great. Hey, Bert, can we tell the people about the free offer?
Free offer. Go ahead. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. If people want to go to our website, yourvirtualaccountingoffice.com, there's a special report on there that they can download on how to create a strong password because we're security freaks over here.
They
can also get a complimentary subscription to our quick biz tips that I think you've got the ebooks on those.
I love it. I love it. All right. So go to yourvirtualaccountingoffice.com. Check out how to create a strong password. You can also get a subscription to their quick biz tips. Carolyn Brown, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you, Bert.
Good stuff there. Great, great show. I love today's show. It's all about your mindset, your money, and your business. I mean, This is what makes Money for Lunch awesome and powerful. There's so many tips here that you can use over and over again. and to make your business and your life better. I just, you know, this is what we're all about. Anyway, remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch and check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.